Okay, good evening. I will make this quick since it is 7 o'clock. Last week, I mentioned that we were going to offer the refuge ceremony for those who have never taken refuge on Saturday, June 10th. It is actually Friday, June 9th. So if you go to the Kadampa Center website and you click on the calendar and you click Friday, June 9th, and you click on the Sakadawa or on the refuge, the link about refuge, there's a whole bunch of information there. So it'll say kind of these are the refuge, this is about the vows you can take, here's the link to sign up. So it's not just what I said last week, get in touch with Donna. It's like all listed there for you. So as Shanka mentioned, and we always mention, we're not trying to make you be Buddhist, but we do want to make you aware of this opportunity so that if it is your wish that you have all the information there. So Donna kindly put it all up and has a lot of information. So go to Kadampa Center website on the calendar, Friday, June 9th, and find out more. It's going to be at 7 p.m. on a Friday. All right. Any questions on that? What's your question? How often does Geshe-la offer refuge? Someone mentioned to me they did it a couple years ago. So the question is, are you supposed to take refuge before dawn? We take precepts always before dawn, and this is what I think. Sometimes the refuge ceremony for the very first time happens at the same time as precepts, but it doesn't have to.
Sakadawa that day, right? That's the day of when the Buddha, it's a anniversary of when the Buddha achieved enlightenment. I think
birth, enlightenment,
and death. That's right. It's all one. So it's a very auspicious day. So normally, normally people take precepts that day anyway. Those who have taken refuge already, but normally when you take refuge, it's done. Well, it depends on the master, right? In this case, Geshe-la is doing it in the evening. So, but it's a very auspicious day. So taking refuge on Sakadawa is like a really, really great thing. It has, much more meritorious, basically. You know.
So precepts are vows that you take for one day. And that is separate from the once in a lifetime taking refuge, although I guess you can renew refuge, maybe.
So, we are all human, right? So even though you can take refuge vows and you may mess up, right? So if your vows have been broken, then you can retake refuge yourself, right? Or what we do is whenever someone is giving refuge, we just, even though we've taken refuge with some other master, we just go ahead and take another one again anyway. It never, it's always good, to get it from a qualified master. So it never hurts, but you can also, if you've broken, this is true for any vows that you take, whether it's lay vows, refuge vows, bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, tantric vows are more difficult, but we won't go there. But in general, you can purify your, broken vows and retake your vows, yourself as well. There's some practices, but you can do that.
And that's kind of all laid out on that page. So there's a link to kind of like where you start. This is refuge. And then when you take refuge, you can take up to 5 lay vows. And those are the ones that Shanka mentioned and last time. And then on certain days, you can take precepts, which adds a couple more vows just for that day. And so that's kind of laid out. And so I'd read through that information and then see what makes sense to you and what doesn't after that.
I wouldn't say I've studied Buddhism, but I've The ideas of Buddhism have been present in my life for many years, and though I would love to experience the ritualism of, I guess, refuge, I mean, many of us in this room may feel this way, but I don't know that I'm quite worthy of it, like, there yet. So, I mean, how do you address that? I mean, it's like, I would like to go because I just think it would be, the ceremony of it would be amazing and probably very cleansing, I guess, but I don't know if it's...
Well,
really
I think that, you know, as with any commitment, right? It's a lifetime commitment you're making, right? So it has to be done with forethought and also with, clear clarity on one side, right? So if you have doubts, then I wouldn't take it, right? I mean, for whatever reason, I mean, I'm sure you're worthy. That's not the issue. But maybe you just don't feel ready yet, which is fine, you know. I didn't take refuge for many years, you know. I waited 7-8 years maybe. So, you know, it's up to you. If you feel comfortable, do you feel this is the path and you feel a sense of commitment, and if if this path has really helped you, then it's a step that, you know, I would take, you know. If it's something that you are, let's say you're coming to this class to kind of just see what it's like, which, you know, which is fine, right? And you take some things that work for you, but you decide, well, you know, and this is not quite for me, you know, I'll go back to my tradition, but hopefully it'll reinforce your refuge in that tradition, right? So you can then, you know, it brings you more commitment to that tradition, which is fine, right? So take refuge only if you are really, you know, if you feel that this is the path for you, right? I mean, that's important. You know, it's not something that you just take and then just walk away from it.
Although precepts are one day vows. And
right.
On auspicious days, we often offer precepts.
Right. So once you've taken, I don't think you need to take refuge. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So the good thing that, thank you for, yeah. So precepts are basically essentially vows you keep for one day to be like a monastic. That's really what it is. You're monastic for a day. I mean, very, very condensed, you know, the monastic, depending on what level you're at, you know, novice or to all the highest level. At the highest level, you have 260-odd vows you have to keep, you know. But we don't have to do that for precepts. So it's basically just, no, you know, the same five of them, no killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, actually sexual conduct that day, no sexual conduct, what am I missing? I'm always miss one. Intoxicants. No intoxicants, right. And then there's a couple of others, like in the vow that takes no sitting on high beds. What that really means is that, you know, people get pride or arrogance when they're sitting on a throne, for example, or, you know, that kind of thing. But it's in the book, in the thing, it says sitting on high beds because it was written 2,500 years ago, right? So, and then there's no music, no dancing, no. It's kind of like to detach yourself from the worldly things that you're attached to, right? So I don't want to say worldly pleasures. I guess it is true for that day. So anyway, so those are the kind of things. That's an example, and there may be one or two others. Ah, right, the big one. You get to eat breakfast, but after, and you get to eat lunch before noon, or the highest point, where the sun is the highest point in the sky, and between noon and the dawn the next day, you basically do a fast, you know, in which you can have liquids, you know, water, juices, without pulp, because that's like food. But anyway, so like that, so you do a fast for a day, you know, because monks And nuns originally, you know, basically only ate, actually they only ate like one or two meals at the most a day, right? So it's kind of like living like a monk or a nun. So that's what precepts are. And you can take those without having taken refuge, and you can, normally we take them on auspicious days because it has much more power, you know, it's all about, as you spoke, you know, all about accumulating as much merit so that we can create the causes and conditions for continuing on the path, you know, gaining realizations, you know, all these things require merit, right? So all of the things is about, you know, creating the causes for it, you know, for the fertile ground for it.
If you weren't sure if you're going to take refuge, would it be all right just to come and watch the ceremony?
Sure. Anybody can. It's not a secret thing. So anybody can come. You know, you can read along with, you know, the refuge the master guides you through it. It's only like 3 pages, you know. So you can read along with them, but you don't have to take the vows. You know, you can just be silent when it says, I won't do this and I won't do this, blah, 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 right? So you can, that's fine. Yeah, sure. Anything else about refuge and precepts and so forth and so on?
Friday, June 9th at 7 p.m.
Friday, June 9th at 7 p.m.
And if you are actually going to do the refuge ceremony, there's a link on the website to sign up. You get a name, and there's a little bit of administration there. So it's important to let the coordinator know that you are planning on doing it.
Yeah? Is that it? Okay. So then why don't we start with a short breathing meditation, and then we'll do a short kind of an experiential refuge meditation. So let's take our seat. So remember, if you remember the 7-point posture, you can go through it in your minds and how to sit. Otherwise, the most important thing is to keep your back straight, but with relaxed, natural curvature. So let's rejoice that we made the effort, that we're on the spiritual path. That we're interested in such things, you know, to become kinder, gentler, more patient, more compassionate. We see the value in those things. You know, there's so many things that we take for granted, like this human life, the body that we have, the clear mental faculties that we have to understand the teachings, to put them into practice, to know right from wrong. Because there's so many others who don't necessarily have the ability or the inclination. And are leading themselves into continual suffering. And of course that, you know, we have qualified masters like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Geshe-la, His Holiness Dalai Lama, who are continuing to do such, you know, who are spending their whole lives, every moment of their lives for our benefit. So that's an amazing gift that we have given ourselves to our virtuous actions in previous lives. So there's a lot to rejoice about. So let's take a moment and just, you know, because we tend to always see how much we don't have. Just take a moment and notice how much we do have. So as with any practice, we first set the motivation for it. So we're here, we're interested because we want a solution to our suffering in this life and in future lives. You know, we're deluded in so many ways. So we need a way, we want to find a way out. So what's the way out? It's enlightenment. So we want to, you know, practice renunciation, you know, become compassionate, generate wisdom so we can, you know, attain liberation, but that's not enough because, you know, all these other beings also are suffering emotionally, psychologically, physically, like we are. If it's not one thing, it's another. So, if they're suffering just like us, and if they've been our mothers in previous lives, our fathers and brothers and sisters and husbands and wives and everything else, sons and daughters, you know, so how can we only think of ourselves? So our motivation is the supreme motivation of enlightenment so that we can benefit all beings, be able to bring them, guide them to enlightenment. So that's the reason we are on this path and taking these Discovering Buddhism courses, coming on Sunday mornings to hear Geshe-la, here, and we're here today. So with that motivation, we can think about refuge for a few minutes. So imagine that you have some really grave illness, you know, maybe it's psychological, maybe it's a physical, maybe you have had something like this in your life, or maybe you know someone who has had something like this happen in his or her life, and you can kind of, you know, take that on and just imagine what it would be like to be in that situation where we are truly, you know, we are suffering, our body is suffering, our mind is suffering, intense suffering, really. So just take a couple of moments and just really, you know, feel it. So I think about my mother, for I haven't had any grave illness that in my life, but I think of my mother at the end of her life in the hospital bed with tubes and respirators and all those things connected to her. So I know the suffering she felt. So now, you know, imagine that someone tells you that, you know, there is this guy over there, you know, maybe very far away, maybe here, who actually knows exactly what problem you have. You know, like, he can solve your problem. I mean, your suffering will be removed. All this pain, all this worry that you're feeling would just go away. So how would you feel? I mean, someone just told you, you know what? This can just all go away. Would you run to him? Spend your last dollar to buy that plane ticket or whatever so that you can get to his office? Make whatever sacrifices you have to make so that you can, so your life can be saved or your mind can be put to rest? I think we would, right? We would do anything possible in that situation to try to find a solution. And let's say he sees you and he says, okay, you have to do this, this, and this. Well, first of all, actually, before that, you get there and you examine him. You know, does he really seem like he actually is the kind of guy who would know him? I mean, you know, has he healed other people like me? is there some evidence that that what he says will actually, you know, I'm probably paying him a lot of money, so I want to get my money's worth. So can he really do what he says? And let's say you have that evidence because you meet others who have been cured with the same type of illness that you have. Maybe he has, you know, written lots of papers in medical journals and so forth and so on that explain. So you have some trust. That this guy is not a charlatan. He really does know what he's doing. You know, maybe you've even interviewed other doctors to see how, what they think of him. So once you have some confidence that this guy knows what he's doing, you know, he says, okay, you do this, this, and this. And, you know, then 6 months from now, you'll be, you know, right as rain or whatever you call it. And, you know, you'll be like your old self again. So how, you know, would you then take that medicine or do what he says? Maybe there's exercises or whatever. Would you follow his advice with diligence? To the letter, you know? Because remember, you're close to, you know, death maybe, or you're close to insanity or a nervous breakdown. And this is the only way out. So what kind of effort would you put in to follow his advice? Would you waver? Maybe, you know, after a while, seems like it's a lot of work. But maybe you still have that confidence that if I keep going, because I had seen these other people who had been cured, that you think about that and you continue going, following the advice, you know, the regimen of pills or whatever you're given. So you have the supreme confidence. You know, you've essentially taken refuge in his abilities and in him, really. Because he's your savior. And maybe there's, you know, along with that, there's a support group, you know, with people who have same type of illness that you have, and so, you know, you go to the support group once a week or whatever it is, and you meet in a circle and you kind of talk to each other about what has worked, what hasn't worked. You know, the days that you feel depressed, they bring you up. You know, they keep saying, keep going, you know, you have to keep going, don't worry, it'll we had the same types of problems. So you kind of keep each other going, give advice, find joy even within the hardship. So those people in that group, you know, are like our spiritual brothers and sisters on the path, you know, the Sangha. So, you know, we have some confidence in them as well, because they're maybe a bit further ahead in their cure or in their illness, you know. So that's the way we kind of have to look at this, because we have the ultimate illness. Whatever physical illness, mental illness, problems with our family, problems at work, self-doubt, you know, problems with self-esteem. All those things, you know, will go away one way or the other. You know, either we'll overcome them or they will be gone at death. But the ultimate suffering, ultimate illness, if you will, is not going away. And we have to think, who has a solution? You know, who has the teachings that I can examine in great detail to really make sure that they are true, that they make sense? So who can help us? Because this continual suffering is unbearable. Think about it, life after life after life. And if we, as His Holiness has said, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche has also said, if we spend this life without having made any spiritual progress, we are no different than an animal. We have wasted this life. Animal hasn't wasted its life because it didn't have a human life in the first place, but we have a human life. But if we only spent it on worldly pleasures, accumulating more wealth or power, prestige, status, it's no different than an animal, that how it spends its life. So we have spent so many lives just like that. So now we have this opportunity, we have the teachings, it's laid out in front of us very clearly, step by step. So we have to think about it like that when we, you know, when we are generating refuge, you know, how important it really is. This is not just an academic exercise. So with that, let's dedicate whatever merit we've gained by this meditation. May it benefit certainly myself. May I, you know, be able to generate refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. You know, you know, so that I can have the supreme confidence, and it's in my striving that it's leading somewhere positive, and that all my efforts, may they be only be of benefit to other beings, so we can help them as well. That actually went a little longer than I was expecting, but in any case, you know, sometimes the spirit moves you. Is that what they say? All right. So last time I mentioned something about inner refuge. Remember that? And I was not happy with my answer. You know, I don't think I was very clear what it meant. You know, we talked about the refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? Which is considered quality, kind of like the outer refuge, right? And there's something called, which is like, of course we have to have refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? But the inner refuge is the refuge, if you will, in ourself, right? In our goodness, you know, the purity that we already have in our heart. The Buddha nature, you know, that's the technical term they use, right? Each of us has the ability to become Buddha, a Buddha. So the inner refuge is understanding that and seeing that, truly having confidence in ourselves, right? To be able, you know, to continue on the path, right? And so I was looking up, like, what other practitioners, how have they kind of described this, right? So remember I told you about that book by the famous nun, Reflections on a Mountain Lake, you know, by, I forget her name, Tenzin Palmo, thank you. So I went back to that book, and because I really like that book, and it says that, and she actually says, and she certainly is a very high practitioner, and she said, in the end, the practice is our refuge. This is not perhaps what I should be saying as a Tibetan Buddhist, but honestly, merely being caught up in the circle surrounding a guru, spending all our time jockeying for position and making sure the law... Okay, this is kind of like in the context of, you know, a spiritual teacher, right? Which is the next module, I think, that's coming. So this is the kind of spiritual teacher that she's talking about. But basically what she's saying is, whatever, if we're just, you know, being caught up in the worldly pleasures, right? Emotions, gain, loss, happiness, sorrow, praise, blame, fame, you know, those eight worldly concerns that maybe you guys were introduced to, right? So if our time is being spent with that, then of course it's not the spiritual path, right? We're not making progress if all we do is follow the eight worldly concerns. But if we have, you know, if we actually follow our teacher, what the advice that he gives, or the advice the Buddha gives, or the advice that His Holiness gives, and if we follow that with confidence, you know, with dedication, right? That is the inner refuge, you know, that is the practice is our inner refuge, right? Because that is what's going to allow our Buddha nature to flower, right? So, did that make sense? Yeah? So, yeah, so that's kind of, you know, it's a little abstract, but really, I mean, and then, of course, as I said, if you're practicing Tantra, then there's other layers that are added on top of this, which I won't go into. You know, inner refuge there means a little bit something different, but still, it's basically that. Okay. All right. So today, we've kind of covered, like, you know, why refuge, the advantages of refuge, and so forth and so on, right? So today, you know, I'm kind of following the Lamrim, or the liberation book, if you will, right? The topics, although I'm using a commentary that's not the liberation book, but it's basically the same sequence of topics, right? So as a reading, before I forget, as a reading, if you would read the section where it talks about, you know, why the Buddha is a qualified or worthy object of refuge, right? So there's a, I forgot the page now. I looked it up in that book, but you know, it's in. So you can see it in it's that section. So there's four reasons that are given why the Buddha specifically is worthy of the highest refuge, right? So the four are, and you don't need to write this down because it's in the book. The Buddha has attained the fearless state of complete self-control. I mean, may not be the exact words that are there in your text, but this is basically it. So the Buddha has attained the fearless state of complete self-control. The Buddha is an expert in training disciples or knowing the solution, you know, knowing the path. The Buddha has great compassion. And finally, the Buddha does not take delight in material offerings, but rather is pleased by the offering of spiritual practice. Right? So those are the four reasons. So, you know, when you're doing analytical meditation, right? So that's something, you know, when you read this, if you could kind of, you know, spend 10 minutes in the morning and just think about it, right? You know, think in your mind, right? You know, maybe take one of these, you know, each day take one of these points, right? And you just think about it in your mind, the points that it discusses in the text, right? Why, you know, whether it really is true or not. I mean, do you believe that, right? And if you do, why? Right? What is it about, what is it that makes sense to you, right? Why do you believe it? And also, truly, you know, examine it, right? Is this really true? I mean, you know, is the Buddha really have the fearless, what does it mean to have the fearless state of self-control, you know? And what would it be like, right? And would you really think that, you know, like, you know, what does it mean, right? And how would you expect, for example, the Buddha, you know, to, you know, what would it be like to have that kind of fearless state of self-control, right? So there's explanation in the text, right? So you can kind of go through it, and you can use your, you know, sometimes you use examples of that you might have in your, you know, that you've come across in your life or something you've read or, you know, whatever, you know, you can use those examples or something that Geshe-la has said, you know, maybe on a Sunday morning or you know, so like that, you can examine it, you know, look at it from all the angles, right? And try to refute it if you can, right? So you can kind of do an analytic, that's how this text is designed, is really to do as an analytical meditation through all the topics, right? And that's how we generate that sense of refuge, right? Is when we do the analytical meditation over and over again, and at some point you get a sense of, aha, this actually really is true, right? That's the realization, right? To have a true sense of refuge, right? But until then, you just have kind of faith because it says, Geshe-la said so, or this book says so, or, you know, so-and-so said so, right? But that's not really a realization, right? It's after you do all these meditations and it becomes true for you is when you have the actual refuge, right? So anyway, so... So it says here, the Buddha achieved complete peace. In other words, he completely eliminated all of the mental afflictions of hatred, attachment, pride, and so forth. And the result of eradicating all these faults is a state of fearlessness, because one is no longer under the power of uncontrolled causes and conditions, right? So think about that, right? Someone who has totally removed all, you know, all the faults, right? All delusions, you know, all obscurations, you know, he's supremely self-confident. He's supremely compassionate. He is spontaneously able to just generate compassion for someone, right? You know, his mind is unperturbed, always in joy, right? You know, never wavers from joy, no matter what happens, right? Someone who is, you know, in the midst of, you know, strife or war or problems within the family or whatever, is able to see through all that and have the long view, right? He's not affected by the moment by moment things that happen that come up, right? I mean, those are the obscurations we suffer from, right? I mean, you know, when someone attacks us, we get in a defensive crouch and, you know, and we act out, or we strike back, right? We don't see the other person for really a person, right? But the Buddha is totally, completely different, right? He sees that person as a human being just like me, right? With the same faults, you know, with the same whatever. Well, the Buddha wouldn't say that he has the same faults as me, because the Buddha is, of course, has no faults. But I'm just, as an example, right? The Buddha would know that this person, you know, is worthy of compassion, that this person is worthy, period, right? So that's the fearless state of, you know, that he's talking about. Totally eliminated mental afflictions of hatred, attachment, pride, and so forth, and eradicated all the faults. Yeah, so it says that there's two things that Buddha, you know, like, there's two things that Buddhas have, there's two, what are they called? Two eliminations? I can't remember. Anyway, so it's achieving all the realizations, right? And eliminating or eradicating all obscurations, right? The Buddha mind, there are many qualities of the Buddha mind, but those are two things, two qualities, right? So if you go to, you know, teaching by Rinpoche, he will talk about that all the time. Like, he will say, Sangye, that's the, you know, Tibetan word, you know, that means, you know, that quality. Let me see, I usually go back and forth between a couple of texts. So let me see what the other text said. So there's, you know, the Buddha, for example, you know, he knows himself, right? It says proclaims, but it doesn't mean like he stands on a soapbox and shouts at people, right? But he can proclaim his own realizations of possessing all qualities and skills. Right, he knows that he is supreme. Right, not in the I'm so great, you know, then better than everybody else kind of supreme. But, you know, it's just one without pride. Right, he knows who he is, has just, you know, eliminated all the obscurations and attained all realizations, and he knows that he is omniscient, and he just knows. Right, he doesn't need to show it. So he proclaims that. He proclaims the cessation of all mental obscurations, right? Every single obscuration, you know, every single imprint, negative imprint, that's what an obscuration is, right? Every single negative imprint that could possibly be in one's mind is totally gone, right? Eradicated. He can proclaim what others have to become free of. This is not in the text, by the way. This is just, there are four things that fall under this bullet, if you will. So he can proclaim, you know, how others can be free, right, and get to the same state as him. He knows what all the delusions that we have and how to get rid of them, right? And right, and he can proclaim without confusion or doubt, you know, what the antidotes are, what are the opponent forces, they call it, but basically antidotes to all our problems, right, all our delusions. What to do, you know, if you came up to the Buddha and said, you know, I have this and this problem, what should I do? He will tell you exactly what it is, right? It may not be, it may seem too elementary. Actually, it's true, like, you go up to Rinpoche, right, and you say, Rinpoche, or you send him a letter and you say, ask for advice, right? I've done this, right? So you send a letter and you ask, anybody, by the way, any of you can do this. I mean, it's not like, you know, only a few people, special people get to do this, right? Or he will answer letters from any student, anybody, not even a student, right? He will answer letters from anybody. So you can, if you need advice, you can send a letter to Rinpoche. So I've done this, and, you know, Rinpoche will write back and he will say, you should do this, this, and this. And you're like, really? What does that have to? I mean, you know, like, you know, you know, practice, you do this as, you know, with the compassionate mind, and you're like, how does that have to anything to do with what I asked, right? But see, he is coming from a different angle, right? He sees. He has an omniscient mind, right? So he sees it totally. He sees my problem totally differently than I see it. I see it with a tiny little, you know, this blinders on, right? But he sees the global picture, right? He knows the antidote. He knows why that will help me, right? He can't explain, you know, he can't explain it to me all the different ways, you know. I mean, he can, he does, but I still don't get it. I mean, that's what I'm saying, right? I mean, he's explaining it all the time. But we are in this state because we have too many obscurations still. We don't quite get it, right? Right. So that's the first point, right? Why the Buddha is worthy of refuge, which was, you know, he's fearless, right? He's attained ultimate peace. The second point is that, you know, he has great compassion, or what did it say? The second point, he's an expert in training disciples. So he, it says, I'm looking at this text from a commentary from Geshe Sopa, and, you know, he says, second, the person in whom you take refuge must have mastered all the ways to help other sentient beings. A proper refuge must be like a skilled doctor, an expert in the techniques of protecting and saving others. Right? So, you know, if you read the Buddha's, you know, if you read the scriptures, if you read the Buddha's teachings, if you read His Holiness's, writings, you can examine. You can say, okay, does this guy really? Is he really enlightened? You know, is he really a Buddha that I should follow? Right. Whether it's a historical Buddha, whether it's the His Holiness Dalai Lama, whom you might consider, who a lot of people consider to be the emanation of the Buddha of compassion, right? Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig in Tibetan. Or those of us, you know, who are Rinpoche students, look at him as a Buddha, so like that, right? So you kind of examine and you say, you know, is this guy really worthy of that, right? And, you know, you inspect, right? You look, I'm kind of going into now this, it's kind of related to spiritual teacher, right, the next module, but you kind of inspect. You look at the teaching, you try to poke holes in it, you look at his other students, right, just like in the meditation we did, you know, you interview other people, you get a second opinion, you ask, you know, does this guy know what he's doing, this doctor, right? You ask his other patients, right? Has this guy really helped you, you know? So, like that, you look around his students, right? I mean, what are his students like? Are they always running around cursing and all? Their minds are not changed. There's no transformation that has happened. You know, or are they truly kind people, you know? They're willing to help. You know, they have, you know, they have made progress, you know, over time, if you have seen progress, you know, like that, right? So then you know he's a truly qualified person, right? Or Buddha, if you will, right? So if you look at His Holiness, the students, or if you look at some of the senior students that Rinpoche has, you know, if you're around not long enough, you know, and you kind of if you socialize with them or whatever, you know, you kind of make their acquaintance, and you look at their qualities, and you will see, you know, you will see the kind of people they are, and that gives you this confidence, right, that this guy must really know something, right? So, the other way they put it is, you know, in Geshe Sopa said, you know, what does it say? Must have mastered the ways of to help other beings. I think in the liberation book it says he is skillful in freeing others from danger, right? That's the Buddha is skillful in freeing others from danger. It's the same as saying, you know, what did Geshe Sopa say? He has mastered the ways of to help other beings, help other sentient beings. Here, of course, helping other sentient beings means spiritually, right? To remove their delusion. So that's the same thing. So they say, for example, the Buddhas, you know, they've mastered the ways. One of the ways they mastered the ways, if you look, you know, there's, I'm forgetting the name of the text now, but you can read the qualities, you know, there's a, you know, text that that tells you what the qualities of the Buddhas are. And one of them, it says, the Buddhas can, when he speaks, or she speaks, I don't mean, when I say he, by the way, you know, I mean he or she. Because I don't like the pronoun they, you know, so anyway, so that's just my thing. they, yeah. So anyway, so when he or she, you know, speaks, it speaks differently to different types of minds, right? It speaks in a way that each person will get what he or she is qualified to get, right? What he or she level of evolution, right? What, you know, that person can get out of it, right? And I have, you know, I know this for a fact because, you know, I have notes from, I don't know, Rinpoche, for example, or Chön Rinpoche, you know, from 15 years ago, let's say, you know? And, you know, I have notes on the side and I wrote down, you know, what I understood, you know, and I read the transcript today, right? And I get a totally different understanding of it, right? It's because my mind is a different type of mind than it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, I understood only at a shallow level, right? I understand. I'm not saying I understand at a deep level. I understand at a less shallow level, let's say, right? Yeah, sir, you know. But what I'm saying is that, you know, if you go to a retreat, for example, where they're very, you know, highly evolved students, and you ask them what Rinpoche said, you get an answer that's totally different from what you understood, right? Because they understand at a different level, right? So, but it's still a benefit. It's the same benefit, right? And so, that's one of the qualities that the Buddha has, right? They also say, like, the Buddha, when he speaks, that's a different aside, but when he speaks, you know, it says, he speaks, people will hear in whatever language they understand, right? I don't know if, you know, exactly how that works or how literally you should take it, but nevertheless, that's one of the qualities, but it's an aside, right? That doesn't matter. So, So, so one of the examples of this is there's a story of called Angulimala, which means in Sanskrit, Anguli means finger and mala means a necklace, right? It's a necklace of fingers. So there was this guy that it says in the scriptures, right? So it goes that there was this guy who had been, you know, who was looking for liberation, and he had found some teacher, and that teacher had told him that if you kill 1,000 people and you collect their fingers and you make a necklace out of their fingers, then, you know, you'll gain liberation, or you'll achieve some level of, realization or whatever, right? And so anyway, so he had 999 fingers by then, and he came across the Buddha, and, you know, and this guy had basically, you know, truly believed. I mean, of course, I mean, if you killed 999 people, I mean, you must really believe, you know. It's kind of like Jim Jones and, down in South America, right? So you must truly believe in what you're doing, right? So anyway, so this guy was, you know, I guess you could say he had taken refuge in his teacher. So he came across the Buddha. I don't remember if the story said that the Buddha was going to be the 1,000th person or not. I can't remember. Or that he was just going to go for someone and the Buddha found him. But in any case, so the Buddha you can read the story, but gave him the teachings, right? At a level that he could understand, right? Skillfully, right? And he was able to show him that why it was wrong and what is the true path, right? And so this guy was able to understand that. You know, that means that he must have created a lot of virtuous, first of all, he must have created an incredible amount of virtuous merit to have met the Buddha, number one. I mean, forget the 999 people. I mean, the fact that he met the Buddha at all was an amazing, sky, as Rinpoche says, skies of merit, you know. Because, you know, you and I are not meeting the Buddha, you know, the historical Buddha, right? So, I mean, clearly we haven't made that. Or maybe we have, you know, we don't know. Maybe 25 years, 100 years ago, we did meet the Buddha. Anyway, so he had a lot of merit that he created to meet the Buddha, but also, you know, he had created the merit to be able to understand the Buddha's teachings, right? There were lots of people back then who basically said, this guy doesn't really know anything. You know, and they didn't follow the Buddha, which is fine, right? They didn't have the merit, but this guy did have the merit, and so he was able to understand the Buddha's teachings. And he changed his course, right? And I can't remember if he had because he was able to purify all his, you know, negativities, and he was able to have a human life the next time, or he was liberated in that one lifetime. I can't remember which happened, but something really, you know, he truly was able to rise past his, you know, negativities, right? The truly, you know, evil actions he had done. Right, killing another being is probably up there, only slightly lower than killing your father or mother and killing the Buddha, or harming the Buddha. Right, those are there's five immediate. They call it five immediate negative karmas. Right, which means that, you know, if you kill somebody in this life, you know, maybe 1,000 lifetimes from now, you'll end up in the hell realms, right? But if you kill your father or mother, you draw the blood of a Buddha, it says, you know, harm the Buddha, cause divisiveness in the Sangha, right? And again, as I said, I always forget the fifth one, so I can't remember what the fifth one is. But if you do any one of these things, then your next life is definitely you're going down into the, you know, hell realms, right? It's like that's an immediate, that's why it's an immediate karma, right? Anyway, so this guy had created 999 of those things, right? Of going, not the immediate one, but, you know, to get to the hell realms, right? So anyway, so, but he was able to, through the Buddha's teachings, so it's an example of how the Buddha can skillfully teach, right? So then the next point it says is that, which is the, you know, really important one, is he has great compassion. And this is also one of the points when you see, when you study the spiritual teacher and the 10 qualities that they must have before you can take them as a spiritual to truly understand, you know, how to gauge somebody as to follow that person as a spiritual teacher, right? They must have 10 qualities, you know. And so this is one of those qualities also for a spiritual teacher. They must, he or she must have great compassion, right? And so Geshe Sopa says, so even if someone is completely free from all fear and has the skill to help others, if he does not have great compassion, he will not protect you. Right? I mean, if he's like, you know, if he just is happy with his own liberation, right? He doesn't need to help you, right? He's, but this guy is there to, for no other reason than to help us. Right? Because he has supreme compassion. Right? He has spontaneous. The Buddha, it's not like the Buddha thinks, his mind, in his mind he's thinking, okay, I see that person is suffering, maybe I should go and help him. That's not how it works. Because the Buddha, by the time that you've eliminated all your obscurations and you've gone through countless eons, great eons of purification and, you know, realization, you know, collecting merit and realization, whatever, your mind is nothing but just compassion. You know, if somebody needs help, it's there, right? There's no, it's not like an active thought, oh, I should go over there and help that person, right? So the Buddha will, you know, so that's why, that's one of the things I like about the spiritual teacher part, you know, that, you know, if you truly understand it, you know, you will see that a Buddha, you know, because of his vows, right, any Buddha for that matter, when I said the a Buddha, that means like any Buddha, because of their vows, they don't have a choice but to help you. Right? It's not like they have a choice. I mean, that's who they are. Right? So if you ask the Buddha for help, they will definitely come. Now, because of our level of evolution, we may not be aware of their presence, right? Or of their action. Right? So you can't, you may not be able to say, oh yeah, the Buddha came and helped me, right? Or so and so, you know, in this form, right? But the Buddha will definitely come, right? That's what it says. Because they are the embodiment of compassion and of skillful means and of, you know, ultimate omniscience and, you know, the power to help us, right? And their vows, right? To always be there to help beings. So, and, you know, sometimes, of course, the way they help you is to pile more, you know, shit, I guess, right? Things might get worse before it gets better, and we may not want to, but we may you know, we may progress because of that obstacle, right? We have to see it like that. I mean, because anyway, I'm going into spiritual teacher part now, but they're really related. Refuge and spiritual, you know, the understanding, the benefits of a spiritual teacher are really related. Yes. And I've been teaching the spiritual teacher module for 10 years now, so it's kind of, you know.
I had a question about spiritual teacher. The way that this, when you were reading from that book and it said, maybe I'm not being a good Tibetan Buddhist because, and it was talking about spiritual.
Oh, you mean when I was reading from Tenzin Palmo's book, yeah.
So, because I don't know other traditions.
Yeah.
But I'm starting to think it might be helpful to understand how our tradition thinks about spiritual teacher versus other traditions to kind of understand the place. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
What is different about
right.
us, if anything?
Okay. I don't like to go into other traditions other than the one that I know, right, which is Hinduism that I grew up in, right? I don't like to go into Christianity or any other tradition because I don't know that well and I may say the wrong thing and in Hinduism, for example, you have not just a god, but many gods. But nevertheless, let's say that you believe in one god, right? And you have a teacher, a guru, right, who is advising you on how to, become. In Hinduism, of course, the ultimate goal is to become one with, that spirit, right? So. He's kind of guiding you on to how to do that, right? What it says is, and if what it says is that you have, you of course have ultimate refuge in that person, right? In that guru, right? And you follow his advice, just like we're talking here. You follow his advice to the letter, exactly what he says, because you have this faith in him. You have generated the faith in him. The difference in Buddhism is that because of what I said, that the Buddhas will appear, they have no choice but to appear, and they will appear to us in the form that we can see or feel or sense, right, or perceive, right? They will appear because, we can't be in the presence of the Buddha Dharmakaya, his omniscient mind, right? That's called a Dharmakaya. But anyway, so because we're not evolved, right, to that level, right? If we were like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, or if we were like, Lama Tsongkhapa, or if we were like who could speak directly to Manjushri, then yeah. We could do that, but we can't, right? Because we have all these obscurations and blah, 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 delusions, right? So we have this human body. We're not there yet. So what it says in Buddhism is, the way a Buddha appears to us is through the form of our guru, through a form of our teacher, right? So when one truly sees, when one truly has taken refuge, examined the teacher, does he have those 10 qualities or not, and says, and looks at, goes to his teachings, follows his advice, and has true faith, generated true faith in his abilities, and that this is the correct path, that he's leading in the right direction, that he knows what he's telling, he has traveled the path, so in Buddhism, at least in this tradition of late Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, you are to see the spiritual teacher as no different than the Buddha, right? So it's kind of like the Buddha who has appeared in front of us. Okay, you can think of it like this, right? If the Buddha had to appear in front of us and give us teachings, what form would he take? Right? If he came as an ant, we wouldn't really look at the ant as a teacher, right? If he came as, even if he appeared in, so the only way we could come, see someone as a teacher is through the form of a spiritual teacher, right? The only way the Buddha would appear in a way is through a spiritual teacher. If he had to give teachings, he has to be able to speak, he has to have a human body, so forth and so on, right? So there are many, you can do that meditation, there's lots of points in there in the next talk. It'll be very interesting, by the way. It's a very interesting topic, It's a difficult topic, but it's a very interesting topic. So you do all these meditations to see if that's really true or not, right? So that's the difference in this tradition, right? And also because, you know, this tradition also is heavy on Vajrayana, on tantric, in the tantric path, right? So that there it's absolutely essential. I mean, absolutely, it's a precondition in the tantric path to see the guru as of the same nature as the Buddha, as a deity, actually, whatever deity that you're practicing. So, did that answer your question or no?
I have more questions, but I think I'm going to save them for the
okay.
next module.
Next, you mean the next module?
Yeah, it is. The
okay,
next
good.
Module.
All right, good. I'm moving the hot seat for. It's a really wonderful, you know, it's a really wonderful topic. You know, if you truly, you know, anyway, I won't go there. Let's just, I could keep going and then we'll run out of time. Oh, wait, you have to use the mic. I'm sorry, there are people on the...
I was just wondering how you think of the Buddha. Is the Buddha a god in your view?
Oh, well, that's an easy question. The Buddha is not a god, because in Buddhism there is no god. So,
Buddha is a spiritual being.
First of all, the reason that there is no god in Buddhism is very simple, right? God is omnipotent. Is unitary. In other words, he is, you know, is a you know, or rather, he has always been she, he, however you look at it. He has always been, always will be, and, you know, has this power, right? You know, especially like a creation type god, right? In Buddhism, as you may have learned already, you know, everything depends on causes and conditions, right? Everything, right? So there is no way a god could exist, because a god would be beyond, would transcend causes and conditions, right? Right? A god would have to be present. You know, god would has been always, will be always, right? And cause and conditions means that something can only arise due to a particular cause, and that cause, or rather the condition, immediately after it arises, will start degenerating. So at some point, the god will have to die. Right? Therefore, there can be no such god. Buddhism does have god realms where there are such things called gods, but they are not the omnipotent kind of god that we're talking about. They're just highly, much more highly realized kind of like human beings. Okay? So they talk about, when it talks in the text about Ishvara, which is the Hindu Sanskrit term for gods and stuff, right? The Buddhists said the Hindu gods are actually just like, they're in the god realm. They're not really gods. They don't, you know. And I can go on and on about how they're different than a Buddha, right? But a Buddha is, gods are still have the obscurations. Okay? And you can, in a way, you can see this if you study Hindu texts, or if you, you know, grow up in India and you read all the mythologies and, you know, or the stories, the epics, right? The Mahabharata and the Ramayana, you know, these epics, like it's equivalent to the Iliad and the Odyssey in India. And they talk about these gods, right? And these gods are constantly fighting with each other. They're having sex with some other god's wife. I mean, like, you know, it's they're just like human beings. They're jealous. They're proud. They're this. They're that. I mean, you're like, how are these guys gods? You know, I mean, how are these guys truly enlightened? They're not. And that's why the Buddha has none of those things. You know, the Buddha is, you know, he's not omnipotent, by the way, right? A Buddha is omniscient. But he's not omnipotent. Omnipotent means that he can, you know, just make things happen, right? An omnipotent God would be able to just, if I prayed to him, he could make me enlightened just like that, right? But because, again, in Buddhism, everything depends on causes and conditions, I can't reach enlightenment until I've created the causes to reach enlightenment. A Buddha can't create the causes for me. Buddha can create the causes for him to be enlightened, but not for me to be enlightened. He can guide me on the path so that I can create the causes for enlightenment, but he can't do it for me. So that's why Buddha is not omnipotent, but he is omniscient. Right? He can see the past, he can see the future, he can see every, you know, all our karmas, you know, so forth and so on, right? So that's how he is not a god.
Would you argue, well, if you say that, then you're implying then that there's some meaning of God, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's...
I guess what you're saying is...
Just put it right next to your mouth. Just put it right next to your mouth.
But I guess what I was just saying was that to me, when you use the term God, it may mean different things to different people, I guess.
Yes,
there isn't necessarily a one.
Okay, so I don't want to get sidetracked here, but I will just say that in Buddhism, there's certainly a definition of what a god would be. If a god truly existed, what he would be,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the definition is that he would have to be permanent.
Yeah.
He would have to be unitary, that there is only one of, you know, like, the, you know, that he can't change.
Yeah.
Well, permanent means he can't change,
yeah.
Right? So he's not dependent on cause and conditions. He's unitary, that means that, you know, he has, there's one soul with whom you are, you know, in Hinduism, like, you know, you become one with him, right? That unit. And omnipotent. I think that's the third one. I can't remember. So if it satisfies those conditions, then that's a god. So it's kind of like a creator god we're talking about here, right? Like in Hinduism, you have Brahma who created the god, you know, the world, and you know, each eon is one blink of his eye, and so forth and so on, right? So anyway, so let's kind of stop that. I'm sorry, but, you know, if you have other questions, we can go, you know, later, but, yes.
For me, and I don't know if this view is correct, but Buddha, the historical Buddha, is not a god because he was a prince, and that's what I love about Buddhism, that he was a human being just like all of us, and he became enlightened, and he was able to see, like, reality as how really it is, and he was able to teach or guide people to, they were able to see that kind of reality. But that's what I love about Buddhism, that you could be a Buddha, and I could be, and everybody could be, if you just...
That's a good point, yeah.
So it's not a god.
Other religions, you know, it's not like... You know, you become, you become Brahma or so on, so forth and so on, right? You become one with, you know, your goal is to become one with, you know, to go to heaven, reach heaven and be one with him, right? But you're not going to be him, right? Right? You won't have his powers. You're not going to become omnipotent and omniscient and permanent and so forth and so on, right? So... And I think most religions are like that, right? Abrahamic religions are like that, right? And probably lots of others. But Buddhism certainly is basically, you know, everybody has this Buddha nature, the seed, purity in them, in him or her. And, you know, all of us can get there, right? If we just, you know, if we have the faith and if we make the effort and, you know, create the cause, you know, accumulate the merit and so forth and so on, right? Each of us can get there, right? Become Buddhas, you know, fearless and so forth and so on. Okay. So he has great compassion, right? And what that means is that, you know, regardless of how tiny we are, tiny, you know, in evolution or tiny like an ant or whatever, right? Regardless of how tiny we are, he sees us the same way, right? You know, he sees each of us equally. You know, it says like in the, again, in the same text where it talks about the Buddha's qualities, one of the other qualities it says is he sees, I think I mentioned this the first class, he sees everyone as attractive, right? Which doesn't mean physically attractive, but rather he sees the inside, right? He sees our true nature rather than our outward behavior, right? So he sees that everyone is beautiful, right, in that sense, right? And that's why a Buddha does not treat his or her wife or husband any differently from the next door neighbor, right? He has the same love, the same compassion, the same sense of, you know, he will go and sacrifice himself for his next door neighbor just like he would for his son, you know, or daughter or whatever, right? So this is that just because he doesn't distinguish between me and mine, right? Reason we hold our families dearer than our next door neighbor is because, you know, it's my family, right? Next door neighbor, what does he have to do with me, right? I couldn't care less, right? So the Buddha, of course, has attained the ultimate wisdom where he sees for things as they really are, that the next door neighbor is no different from me or my wife, right? And he has that realization. He lives it, right? So that's why he sees everyone equally. You know, and then there's a story, for example, of, the Buddha had a cousin called Devadatta who was, you know, this is a true story, but anyway, Devadatta who had, who was very jealous and tried to kill him like at least a couple of times, you know, once with a rock and once with an elephant. But anyway, and then the Buddha had a son, of course, right? He had his son Rahula, and so he treated both of them exactly the same way. You know, he taught both of them, you know, the same. He gave them both the same. Now Devadatta, he wasn't able to take advantage of the Buddha's teachings as his son did, right? But he gave the same opportunity. Again, because he's not omnipotent, he can't make Devadatta become like his son, right? But he gave the same opportunity to both of them, right? He didn't distinguish between one who... There's another story, for example, like one of the examples they give of a Buddha of his ultimate compassion is like, you know, if he's sitting there and somebody is, you know, massaging perfume and oil and stuff on his right-hand side, and somebody else is chopping off his limb on his left-hand side, he sees both of them the same way, right? He does not distinguish between friend and enemy, right? Because he has this ultimate compassion, right? Because to them, both of them are, he sees the inside. He does not see the behavior. He does not see the actions as defining them, right? We see their actions as defining them, right? That's the fault that we have. We have not been able to eradicate. Because, anyway, you learn in the last module, because we have a different sense of what reality is, how the ego exists, how the I exists, how phenomena exist, and so forth and so on, right? It's a totally deluded view. Let me see. Another place it says like, so I'm almost at the end. So what I'll give you a true real life example now, right? And I give this to like, since I do the spiritual teacher, when I give this in the spiritual teacher module, but I'll give it to you in this module. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche, right? So, for example, and this, you know, once I was at a retreat with Lama Zopa Rinpoche and, you know, a bunch of other of his students. And it was late at night, and, you know, Rinpoche, back then, nowadays his students make him stop teaching at 11:30 or 11 o'clock or 11:30 because, you know, you know, because he has, you know, all these physical ailments, right? So they make him stop, even though he will just keep going, right? But back then, we're talking about 10, 20 years ago, he would just, like, he would start at 7 o'clock, and you knew that it was not, you know, maybe it says it's going to end at 10, but you knew it was going to go on until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. But he would just keep going without break, right? Because, you know, of course, he has this amazing, like Buddhas, he has, he has this amazing, he doesn't get tired. Right, that's another way to put it. Right, he can just keep expounding. But anyway, so 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, finally he stops. We're really all just bleary eyed. We just want to get to bed. Right, that's really all we want to do. Right, but Rinpoche is walking. Right, so we can't just walk in front of him and just go to our rooms. Right, so we have to kind of walk behind him. Right, as a form sign of respect. So there we are. Bleary eyed, 3 o'clock in the morning. We're walking behind him, and Rinpoche comes across this dead snake that has been run over on the road by this car. And it was a disgusting sight, let me tell you. Right? It's like flattened. I mean, it's just... But Rinpoche stops so immediately, right? And he just bends down on the snake and goes, oh! Like that, you know? And he then gets his mala out and starts doing all his prayers, right? Because he's trying to do prayers so that this snake could have a better life the next time around, right? Because of his amazing compassion, right? And he sees the snake. See, I'm looking at the snake and I'm like, ugh, right? I can't even bear to look at it because its guts are all out and it's just bloody. I mean, it's just like disgusting, right? But he's like, he doesn't see that, right? I mean, he doesn't see that. He sees what the snake's soul, if you will, or what the snake truly is, right? So he starts doing all these prayers, and, you know, and it goes on for 15, 20 minutes, and we're like, oh, my God, you know? And finally he says, okay, you know, you guys all, you know, do this with me, and then we'll have to blow on it, right? So you kind of, like, you do these mantras, and you blow on the snake, kind of like blow the, I don't know, it's kind of like giving the blessings on the snake kind of thing, right? So and Rinpoche, of course, you know, finishes all his things, and he's like 2 inches from the snake, and he goes, blows on, you know, like that, right? And most of us, and myself especially, I do the mantra, and I kind of like stand back like this and go, you know? So that's a kind of an example, it's a, you know, but this is what I'm saying, right? I mean, it's a kind of a, you know, there are many other, if you ask other students, there are many other examples like this, right, of his great compassion, right? You know, how he shows up at, like, you know, at retreats, like, you know, it ends at, let's say, 2 o'clock in the, you know, let's say at midnight, right? Like some of those retreats that we have at Black Mountain, you know, here, right? Oh, I got to stop. But anyway, one last thing. So, you know, let's say, you know, old days again, before he had a stroke, it would go on to, let's say, 1 in the morning, right? And it's supposed to start at 5:30, by the way. It always starts at 5:30 in the morning because you have to do a session before dawn, right? You have to take precepts and all the stuff before dawn, so it starts at 5:30. So there it is, ends at 1 o'clock. So we get, like, about 4.5 hours of sleep, maybe 4 hours of sleep, and on to the next day. And you know, Rinpoche teaches till 1 o'clock, and then we go bleary-eyed, we go to bed. And then, you know, half the time, Rinpoche will come down at 5 o'clock in the morning to be with us. Right? He doesn't need to. But he will go through the same prayers as us. Right? It's because we're making the prayers to our spiritual teacher, right? And he knows we see him as a spiritual teacher, so he is providing us the opportunity of collecting more merit by being in his presence. You see what I'm saying? This, when you take the spiritual teacher module, it'll make more sense maybe. But, you know, you get some merit by, you know, making prayers to your teacher and prayers to the Buddhas, right? But if you have a teacher in front of you whom you see as a Buddha, who you see the same quality as a Buddha, it's just amazing much more merit, right? And that's why Rinpoche, even though he left at 1 o'clock in the morning, the schedule says next time you have to appear is at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but he's there sometimes at 5 o'clock in the morning, like just like us, right? Of course, he doesn't need sleep like us, so that's a different thing, right? Because, you know, he really doesn't really sleep. much, you know, maybe an hour here or there, you know, kind of like that. But, yeah. So anyway, so just like, so that's the kind of compassion that we're talking about, right? That the Buddhas have, that the teachers who truly are, you know, have these qualities have. Anyway, so I didn't get to the last point, which is, but maybe, oh, next time I won't be here because I have to be someplace else, but Robbie was going to take my place and he will continue. But the last one was the Buddha does not delight in material offerings, but rather is pleased by the offering of spiritual practice, right? So the short is, what truly pleases the Buddhas is to follow their advice. And same is true in the spirit. When you see the spiritual teacher module, you'll hear the same thing. You know, there are many ways to please a spiritual teacher, you know, to talk about them and you know, to other students so that, you know, other students can, you know, can be exposed to the Dharma and so forth and so on, to give them money to, so that they can, their projects can, you know, reach fulfillment, right? Or to give them flowers or make offerings, whatever it is. But the thing that truly pleases them is if you follow their advice. And the same is true for the Buddha, certainly, right? So that's the best gift you can give a Buddha or a teacher is practice. Right, your practice, you know, to really actualize their teachings. Any last burning question? Yes, so thank you. Readings for next week. So if you would read, I just covered this section on why the Buddha is worthy of refuge. So if you would read that, please. I kind of just really just blasted to the last point because I was already late, but I think you will understand it from the readings. And then in the wish-fulfilling golden sun, I think if you would read the first, let's say, you know, 30 pages or so, something like that. It's not very hard reading, so, you know.
That wasn't on our list, but it's in the same place on the website with all of the online readings. So you can find Wish Fulfilling.
Okay. Oh, it's not on our reading list?
Oh, it is. Just kidding. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah? Okay. So let's finish with our dedication, our really short dedication on page 32 or 6 or 4, one of those. We know that there's dedication on each of those pages. 36, yes. So really think about, you know, that our motivation of helping other beings that we, you know, so this is kind of the bookend, that our practice is really, you know, to help ourselves, but also help our others. So may we dedicate our life to that. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. And let's just do the long life prayer of Lamasapa Rinpoche. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish the magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior, myself, and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Good. Thank you very much. If you wanted to know what the refuge is like in this prayer, you will see that, if you want to see what the taking precepts are like, then there's the pages, Yeah, 33 is how one takes precepts, right? But only, yeah, well, how one takes precepts, period. So if you are able to take precepts on Friday, even if you do... No, I meant like if you do it yourself, right? So... it's a great, very auspicious day. Remember, everything's about creating the cause and conditions, right? So Friday is a very auspicious day. So even if you're not taking refuge, which is fine, right? If you're able to take precepts, so what that means is you get up early in the morning, before dawn, and this precept takes about, maybe if you haven't done it before, you know, read it ahead of time, you know, so that you're familiar with what you'll need to do. But it takes maybe half hour at the most, right? So find out when dawn is, you know, usually at 5, you know, maybe 6, quarter to 6, something like that. So you get up at 5:15, just one day. You know, it's not too bad, too hard. And besides, the weekend's coming up anyway, you get to sleep. So you 5:15 in the morning, you get up and you do, you know, do the prayers, do the precepts, and you know, it's pretty self-explanatory. It tells you what to do. You get down on one knee and you say this, blah blah blah, say this three times, et cetera, et cetera. And have breakfast, have lunch before noon, or the highest point in the sky, you can find that out. It usually is around the summer year, it's around 12:15 or so. And the rest of the day until the next morning, next dawn, you can have water, you can have juice, you know, like orange juice, apple juice, cranberry juice, whatever juices, you know, but without pulp, right? You can have anything that's, you know, like water, right? It's not like food. So milk is like food, right? Because it fills, you know, it fills you up, right? So not milk, but like that, right? You can have tea. You can have coffee, you know. But if you, like, have 1/4 cup tea and 3/4 cup milk, that's also cheating, right? So, you know, whatever normal amount of milk that you use, right, that's okay, right? So that's it. It's not that hard, you know. When we do a lot of times we do retreats 2 weeks, 3 weeks. We take precepts every day. So basically we're having only 2 meals a day and fasting for the rest of the time. It's not that hard, you know, really, you know. So, yeah, but it's of great merit, you know. It's a great benefit, right, because you're living that day in the vows, right? So every action becomes meritorious, every single action of every second, millisecond, right? So living in the vow has that benefit, right? So that's why it's so meritorious. Okay. Yeah? All right. I won't see you next week. And the following week is Memorial Day, so you'll have a holiday. Following week after that, you'll have a wonderful teacher here called Don Hendrick. He's a wonderful man, a friend, and a teacher. So he will do Discovering Buddhism. And then I will see you the following week.